It just was something I couldn't have known that happened. And the thing about it is that I felt there was a layer of life that was torn off, and it actually makes you more compassionate and more afraid to an extent also, because you know that anything can happen at any time. But on the other hand, if you know that anything can happen at any time, then you tend to try to live life to the fullest, which is what I try to do every day.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? You're listening to episode 71 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. If you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with fellow writers, or if you'd like to submit questions for future guests on our show, along with sneak peeks of future episodes, join me over in our new Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you in there. Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. They're the first low residency MFA program in the country to focus exclusively on writing for young readers. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. I'm so very excited to feature Caroline Levitt on our show today. Caroline is a book critic, essayist, screenwriter, and the award-winning author of Cruel Beautiful World and the New York Times bestsellers Is This Tomorrow? And Pictures of You. I met Caroline in her online creative writing class at UCLA's Writers Program, where she teaches step-by-step how to create story structure for a novel. In today's episode, Caroline generously shares all that she's learned and experienced in life and in her writing career. Caroline and I dive deep in our conversation about her intimate experience with loss and grief and how she's able to push forward with strength and courage. This episode is hands down the most emotionally powerful discussion we've had on the show. Caroline also shares the haunting story that inspired her newest novel, Cruel Beautiful World, and she also shares how to find your confidence as a writer and how to edit your manuscript. She walks us through how to create strong characters by using character webs and breaks down the function of a writer's synopsis and how it can help jumpstart your novel. We unpack what the core question means, how the core question brings depth to your story and characters, and how to structure your novel around it. We also dive into Caroline's advice on choosing the right writer's group that will give you constructive feedback, along with her tips on finding a writing mentor through social media. Let's jump right in. Hi guys, I am so happy to have our guest with us today, the lovely Caroline. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm so excited to be on your show.
First of all, I just want to say, everyone, that Caroline is so generous and gracious and kind because we had an amazing interview towards the end of last year.
Yeah.
My hard drive crashed on me when I went to Asia and we couldn't recover Caroline's files. So Caroline has been so generous to give me a do-over and a second chance. So Caroline, I'm so happy to have you on the show. You have no idea. It's been a long time coming. And I actually knew about Caroline because I took her UCLA Extension writing course online. This was during a very pivotal moment of my life. Caroline was my novel writing teacher and I've always remembered really amazing things about her, and I'm so honored to have her on the show. I'm so excited for you right now. There's so many things happening for you. I mean, you have Cruel Beautiful World out right now, and you're in the middle of touring, right?
Yeah, I am. I'm going across the country now. It's actually really fun.
It's so exciting. When did you start your tour?
Oh, I started a month before the book even came out. They
Oh
were
my
sending
gosh.
me to just events to start a really buzz before the book came out. And I'll be touring until I think my last event is April. So it's a long time.
Oh my gosh. Can you give us examples of the cities that you'll be stopping by?
Yep, I've already been to Boston 3 times. I'm going to Washington, D.C. next week and Baltimore. Then I'm going to Phoenix, Tucson, Miami, Missouri, Chicago.
Oh my God.
I have no idea what else. There's a zillion places. There's about 30 different cities.
I am so happy for you. That is so amazing. For listeners who are a bit unfamiliar about the schedule of an author who tours, what is it like for you?
It's really wild. I actually never, even though this is my 11th novel, I never got to tour until my 9th novel. And when I first started touring, I was really nervous because I had never really spoken in front of large groups of people. And I kept thinking, well, maybe I need a talisman. And I saw on eBay this pair of bright red shorts. Cowboy boots for $10. And I thought, you know what? Those are the kind of boots that somebody really kick-ass would wear. That's a woman of confidence. So I bought boots and I put them on and I wore them everywhere on tour. And as soon as I put them on, I felt more confident and I was able to go out and talk to people. And I found that I really loved it, that it was really exciting and really fun. This is my 3rd time out touring, so I'm used to it now. I really, really like it. It's really fun to go out and talk to readers and talk to people and to see different cities too.
Red cowboy boots, that's genius.
Funny thing is that the more I toured, all of a sudden people started showing up at my readings wearing their own cowboy boots.
You're kidding.
Funny thing is I don't need them anymore, so I haven't really been wearing them on tour this time, but I have lucky earrings this time around. So.
Did you find them? Did somebody give it to you?
I found them on eBay. They're just Betsy Johnson crazy hoops with metal flowers on them. And the first day I wore them, I got a rave review and I thought, oh, this is great. So I wore them the next day and I got another rave review. So I've continually worn them. And I told my agent that I'm never, ever taking them off. And I'm not taking them off until this book is over.
That's really amazing to hear that you don't need the boots anymore, because it sounds like you're getting super comfortable and very confident with each tour. Do you think there was something specific that changed your thinking process or your psychological perspective when it comes to going to these tours now?
That's a really great question, because I've been thinking a lot about that. Actually, I did a whole lot of work on myself and I talked to a lot of friends and my husband constantly about what I'm really nervous about and how to overcome it. And a lot of it was just cognitive, where I would just tell myself I'm going to go out there and act as if I'm confident and I'm not scared and are not anxious. And gradually I found that if I did that enough times, then I wasn't scared or anxious. It just really helped me a whole lot. And also I discovered coffee. I never drank coffee before. I always thought coffee was just to make you more wide awake. And someone said, oh, no, drink a cup and you'll feel better. And I did. And I felt, oh my God, why didn't somebody tell me that it boosts your mood and it makes you feel so good? So coffee really helped too.
If I have coffee, I get very nauseous. My doctor actually says I should not be drinking coffee, but if I drink a lot of tea with caffeine, I get very jittery. And coffee, when I used to try it, I had the same kind of reaction. And I would get really nervous if I had a high anxiety situation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I think, okay, TMI, but I would get more like on the IBS side rather than the calming side. So I'm really happy to hear that it really works out for you. I should just spray paint your coffee cups red, because you don't have your red boots
anymore.
That's a
good idea.
I know it's hard to pick favorites, but is there a city that you're really looking forward to touring at and stopping by? Or is it all the same for you that you're super excited for all of them?
Well, I'm super excited for all of them, but there are places where I've never been where I love to go. I'm going to Missouri and I've never been to Missouri for this book festival. I'm really excited about that. And then I'm going to this tiny town, this small town in Texas for this event called the Pulpwood Queens. And they're just amazing. This is run by this incredible woman, Kathy Murphy. She has 1,000 book clubs across the country.
What?
And they all, yes, she does. They made a documentary about her. She's passionate supporter of books and authors. And she has this 3 or 4 day festival where all the book clubs converge. And the truly amazing thing about it is that everybody dresses up according to the theme.
Get out.
And it's amazing. I went there a few years ago when the theme was circus, and you have no idea the photographs that I took of the people dressing up. They decked out the tables and all this other stuff. And this year's theme is diamonds. So I bought all these rhinestones and a blonde wig and a feather boa. It's amazing. So I'm really looking forward to that.
That sounds so fun. Good for her doing something that she's so passionate about and encouraging the community. I really look up to people like that who really give back and try to pass that karma forward. That's really, really cool.
Well, you do that. You do that.
Oh my gosh, Carol, like, well, you do that. Don't do even with me. You do no, that. You're the one that's a teacher. You have your own blog. You're always interviewing, spotlighting people in your community and authors in general. Are you kidding me? I'm so fascinated about your life as a teacher because I know just from our chat the first time around, you love writing and you love giving back to community, hence why you teach. And mm-hmm. I can see that through your classes. Where do you teach first off so that listeners can know?
I teach online at Stanford University and also at UCLA Extension Writers Program. I tried teaching in real time and I didn't really like it because my schedule's so crazy and I wanted to be able to choose the time to do it. I found that I really, really loved online teaching and I really, really loved teaching writing. First of all, it helped me with my writing to be able to look at somebody else's writing and try to figure out, well, where is this going and how is it working out for people. And also you get to have this kind of intimacy with other writers that you sometimes can't get in a real class. Sometimes I think online writing makes writers braver. And it's just been so rewarding and so great just to talk to people about their stories. And I started doing more video classes with writers. So then we can see each other. Yeah, it's so much fun. Sometimes it's hard to read critiques online. But I figured when you see everybody's faces and you see that everybody's on everybody's side and everybody's smiling, it makes it a lot easier. And it creates this incredible sense of community so that the writers are all really helping each other. I just love it.
Is that for both Stanford and UCLA?
Yeah.
When I took your class about 3 years ago, we didn't have video conferencing yet.
I started it and it's amazing. I actually want to give out a shout out to one of my students. She came into my class 6 years ago. And she wrote this novel. I liked it. And then she turned in her second novel. And when I saw the first sentence, I freaked out because it was so great. And I contacted her and said, you have a novel here. You have to publish this. I worked with her. And actually, that novel is coming out this May. Her name is Gina Sorrell. And the novel's called Mothers and Other Strangers. And we've become really good friends, which is one of the other things that I love about the class, that you get to meet people and form friendships and contacts. It's just great.
I love her title. It's a beautiful title. I wonder if she came up with it before she finished her manuscript or after.
Oh, I don't know. It's a great title, though,
it
right?
It sounds very haunting. Very haunting.
It is. She's totally haunting. Just the kind of book I like to read.
I'm so excited for her. I'm so excited for you. You're the mentor. That's amazing to see your students come up like that and to shape them. Wow, that is incredible. And congrats to you for bringing in the video conferencing and a little bit more about how that works. I loved hearing why you love teaching online. And yes, I agree with you where sometimes people are a bit more brave behind the screen. For me specifically, I took online classes because I had no time to show up and then to drive to UCLA campus was a bit much for me. So that's why I chose online. For those who are really busy with work, family, young kids and whatnot, what if they're not able to jump on in the video conferencing? Is it required that everyone has to show up?
No, it isn't. And also, I record the video conferencing so that everybody can sort of learn and take notes. And I post it in the class so they can do that. I also sometimes work privately with students because some people are just, they don't work well in groups, but they work really well one-to-one. And that's fine. So I do that. I love to do that too. I'm a big believer in karma and giving back to the writing community because I've been helped so much by other writers and I want to give back. I think that's important.
That's so exciting. For any listeners who are looking for classes and teachers, I personally do endorse Caroline because I've worked with her on myself. She's fantastic and she really cares and she's so kind. And when you do give feedback, it's not crippling. It's not to the point where, oh my gosh, I feel like I'll never write. I remember you were the teacher who made me believe in myself. And I felt, as cliche and as dramatic as it sounds, I did feel like you gave me wings. Felt like I could run with story ideas. I remember you said specifically to our class is to make sure that whatever we write about, it has to be about something that keeps haunting us. And that is your story. So thank you for that. Let's talk more about your writing. I mean, what got you here in the first place? Your newest book that you're touring all of America with is Cruel Beautiful World. Could you give listeners a snapshot of what your story is for those who have not had a chance to check it out yet?
Sure. Cruel Beautiful World is set at that weird time where the 1960s and all the era of peace and love and hope suddenly turned into the 70s, where the war in Vietnam escalated into Cambodia and students were killed at Kent State. And it's actually about love. It's about three different kinds of love. First love of a 16-year-old girl for her 30-year-old English teacher in high school. Last love of the girl's adoptive mother, who finds love in her 80s, and dangerous love. And it's about this girl, Lucy Gold, who she runs off to one of these back to the land paradises that were springing up then with her high school teacher. And it sort of turns out to be a nightmare. And it's up to her older, more stable sister, Charlotte, to try to find out what happened to her sister and why, and if she were at all responsible with it. So that's the story.
That sounds beautiful with Cruel Beautiful World. Sounds like a lot of different stories overlapping.
Yes.
You're a master at that, because I read pictures of you when I was taking your class and I loved it. Where was the inspiration from?
I have been wanting to write this book since I was 17, actually, and I just didn't know how to do it. I was sitting in high school class behind this girl who was 17, and I was talking about how after I graduated high school, I was going to go to college, I was going to go to Paris, and she told me she was engaged to this guy who was much older than she was, and she admitted that he was a little controlling, but she thought it would work out. A year or so later, when I was in college, I heard the news that she had decided to break up with this guy. She wanted to go to college. She wanted to date other people. And this guy went into the kitchen, got a knife, and stabbed her to death 23 times. I was just haunted. We were all completely devastated. And I kept thinking, well, she had been with this guy for years. Had he been violent to her before? And if so, why didn't somebody help her? What was this about? I just didn't understand it, so I couldn't write about it. I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And then 10 years later, 2 weeks before I was supposed to get married, my fiancé died. Really suddenly. And I was really terrible with grief. And I got the bright idea after 4 months that the way to get out of my grief would be to throw myself in another relationship. Even though everybody told me that was a really stupid idea, I did it anyway. And the guy I got happened to be very subtly controlling. He never did anything violent. He was never physical. His voice was always soft. It made me think of myself differently. He kept telling me every day that I would look so much better if I were 10 pounds lighter. And I was 95 pounds at the time. Oh. When someone keeps telling you that, you start to believe it. He sort of monitored my food.
What?
And my friends were getting really alarmed. But, and then he began to monitor who I could see. He didn't want me to see certain people. And the only reason I stayed is part of me was thinking, well, if I leave him, then I'm going to have to grieve. And I couldn't bear that. And the other part was I began to believe the things he was telling me, because they were always said in this soft voice, you know, like, honey, you don't really need to see your friends. You have me. We're the same person.
Oh.
I stayed with him for 2 years, and the breaking point was when he went into my computer and started rewriting my novel to make it funnier.
What?
Yeah, so.
Are you kidding me?
Nope. So I left then. And when I left, I started thinking of my friend in high school, and I began to realize you can be controlled by another person and not even realize it. And I hadn't realized it. And that's how the book started to take shape after that.
Wow. Holy moly. Was that a very emotional process for you writing Cruel Beautiful World?
It was, because as I was writing it, I thought I was really writing about my friend from high school and all that had happened to her and what it was like to be controlling. And then all of a sudden the book took off in a different direction, and suddenly I realized, oh, I'm writing about my mom as well. My mother is this amazing woman, and she actually fell in love for the first time when she was 80. sense. I thought that was incredible.
That is incredible.
So it started to be a love letter to her, and it also started to be a love letter to my older sister, who I was really, really close to from the time we were kids until about the time we were 20. Her life became difficult and we got less close, and it always haunted me that we weren't close. And I kept trying to fix it so we could be close. And the more I tried to fix it, the worse things got. So the book became about, you know, Charlotte, this woman who really is trying to fix everything. And she comes to realize that she can't. There's some things you can't fix. And sometimes you have to let life just sort of wash over you. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised about that in the book, but it sort of gave the book a depth I didn't expect. So that was good.
Oh, that's beautiful, Caroline. With the characters, because there's, again, many different stories layering and characters, how were you able to keep track and make sure that you didn't get sidetracked or that you didn't segue out of your main goal for each character? Just making sure that they go through their character development, their arcs. How were you able to do that without getting lost?
Story structure. Absolutely story structure. I never believed in story structure for many years because I felt it would take away creativity. But now I do, because now I feel like story structure, knowing where a character begins, how they change and how they end, is like the skeleton. And then the story is the muscles and the clothes or whatever else you put onto that. So I map out all my characters, but I map them out in terms of their moral needs and their blind spots and how that impacts all the other characters. So I sort of build what I call a character web, where all the characters are kind of connected. And also, I have to say, I also have a genius editor at Algonquin, and she really helped me put things where they belonged and pare things down and find the story. And that's important. You have to have people looking at your stuff and helping you see the stuff that you yourself don't see.
Absolutely. You were introduced to your editor, I'm assuming, by your agent?
No, that was really an interesting story. I had my very first book that I published did really, really well. And I thought every book was going to be like this. And then my second book failed and my publisher went out of business. And then my third book got picked up by another publisher and they went out of business too. And that book failed. So then I told my then agent I wanted to be with a big publisher who wasn't going to go out of business. So she got me a 3-book deal with a big, big, huge publisher. And they didn't do any publicity for the book. I got 2 reviews for it, which were both excellent, but it wasn't enough for sales. So I didn't sell any books at all, and the publisher dropped me. So I went to another big publisher, and they gave me a 3-book deal, and I thought, oh, this is great. And the same thing happened. Failure, failure, failure. So I was writing Pictures of You, and the publisher rejected it. And they said, it's just not special. We don't get it. And I was horrified. And I said, can I rewrite it to make it special? And the editor said, no, we don't think you can do that. And I said, wow. Well, would you like to look at something else of mine? And they said, no. So I got a new agent who is fantastic. I actually saw that you interviewed her. It's Gail Hockman.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And she's wonderful. And she said, don't worry, don't worry. But of course I was crying and hysterical because if you have 9 novels and you haven't made any sales at all and nobody knew who I was, it's very hard to sell a book. But I had a friend who was at Algonquin and she said, you know, I have this editor I really love. Maybe she'll like your book. Why don't you send it to me and I'll pass it on. My agent sent it to her. And within 2 weeks, I got a call from my editor there, Andra Miller. And she said, you know, I read your manuscript and we all read it here and we all love it and we want to buy it. I said, are you sure? Do you know who I am? I don't sell books and nobody knows who I am. And she said, you will now. They have been amazing. They took that non-special book and they got it in 6 printings, 6 months before publication. And it made the New York Times bestseller list its first month out. They literally changed my life.
Congratulations.
That's why I tell writers, never give up. You never know what's going to happen. Sometimes it's not the right editor. Sometimes it's not the right publisher. Sometimes it's not the right timing, but it doesn't mean that it won't be right 2 weeks from now or whatever else. So it's a great story because it shows that you never know.
It's true. For those listeners that feel like they just keep writing for months and nothing is coming out of it, what can you tell them? Your story just now is just amazing. So I feel like that's already a huge takeaway. But is there anything else that you'd like to add or to say to them?
Yes. The first thing is never, ever give up. Really, never give up. Your job is to just keep writing the story that haunts you, and eventually it will find what you want it to find. The other really important thing that was given to me by another writer was the phrase, if you compare, you'll despair. And what that means is it's very hard not to see other writers getting things that you yourself yearn for and not feeling bad about yourself. But you don't know that other writer's story, and you don't know what obstacles that writer has gone through. It's really not helpful to compare yourself to anybody else. You're on your own journey, and your journey might mean that maybe you won't find success for another 5 years, but when you do, it'll be a huge, wonderful success and you will have earned it. And you just have to be patient and believe in yourself, and then things will happen.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Caroline. And you know, I love that right before this, we were talking about outlining. Outlining is crucial. There's a lot of pantsers and plotters. There's listeners who are trying to become more of the ones that outline instead of pantsing around. These are people coming from being used to writing with the flow of consciousness. Problem is they end up spending double the time revising, and it's a very messy process for them. Yet they feel like it helps out their characters and their world in an organic way. So for them, they feel it helps their characters and their world building, but not having a structure is holding them back when it comes to revising. What would you say to them?
A lot of writers have different methods of writing, and I do know writers who just write and follow the muse, and they have kind of an instinctive sense of what makes a good story. Before I used story structure, I was the same, where I would produce these 800, 900 page novels, and then I'd have to go back and say, well, what is the story? And you can work that way too. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you are that kind of writer where you end up with 800 pages of story after you've just followed the muse, what you need to do is try to find the core question that the novel is asking that haunts you, and answering what's the moral question is. It can be as simple as, does money buy happiness? Or how do you be a part of a community if you're an outsider and the community doesn't want you? And once you know that question, then you sort of fit your characters in there. Well, you might have a character who does seem to fit into the community, but really doesn't. And then you tell her story. And you just build it up that way by all these moral choices that the characters make, and you start honing down your novel. It's not easy, I have to say. It's really hard work. And it takes me 6 months to, at the very least, for me to figure it out and seemingly get it in shape. And even when I get it in shape, I talk to 4 different writers, just talking it out and seeing what they think about it. So it is a process, but I love the process.
Caroline, when you say 6 months to get it in shape, do you mean the bare bones, or do you mean the full manuscript?
Oh, no. It's bare bones. It takes me 4 years to write a novel, sometimes 3. What I do is I write something that I call a writer's synopsis, and it's usually 30 pages where it's just sort of telling the story and touching on the moral choices the characters are making and how the story is going to play out. That's what I use when I start writing. And of course, that writer synopsis changes about 50 times as I'm doing the novel. But the basic question that was haunting me is always the same. And that's always what I'm working on. My question for Cruel Beautiful World was almost always, how do you live in the world when things happen and you didn't foresee them and you can't fix them? I didn't know the answer to that when I started writing the novel. And then I found the answer when I finally finished my 25th draft of it, which was not what I expected. That's how I write my novels.
That's really cool, because it does sound like you do have that freedom in there to leave room for the flow of consciousness to answer yourself. I actually never really talked about spiritual side of writing, but it's been coming up a little bit more now. I feel just hearing you talk about this, it really feels like a spiritual state of mind where you're connecting with a higher world when you're allowing yourself to answer your own question.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's something that I think about a whole lot. I do think there's a spiritual aspect to it. And I actually view spirituality not in the kind of new agey way that a lot of people do, but in a quantum physics sort of way.
Oh, interesting.
Quantum physics is so interesting because it talks about how the universe is much more incredible than anybody could believe. There could be parallel worlds. There are physicists who say there really is no time and everything is happening at the same time. And thoughts are a kind of energy. And That's what I really believe. I think that a lot of times when I'm writing, I'm tapping into some of those things, and it really interests me in how we see the world and how we let ourselves see the world that's sort of bubbling up underneath it. You know what I mean?
Yes,
it's like a whole kind of energy connection. And I think that comes out when you're writing, and I love it.
I love that. And on this topic, it reminds me of when your fiance passed away 2 weeks before the wedding. Is there any story that hits close to home with that specific time in your life?
It happened a long, long time ago. I was a mess for about 5 years after he died. I didn't know how to cope with it. So I took all the money we had saved to buy an apartment, and I traveled the country visiting friends and staying with them. And I saw a whole lot of different psychics and mediums to try to help me make sense of it. I would say that I spent thousands and thousands of dollars on them, and that 99.9% of them were just ridiculous and terrible. And they would tell me things like, oh, this is the best year of your life. But there was one woman I saw in New York City who was incredible. She was absolutely incredible. And she told me things in the future that actually happened. And that made me feel a whole lot better. I started to write about it. I wrote this book, Living Under Lies, which was actually about somebody whose fiance dies very suddenly. And that helped me a whole lot. And I wrote a lot of essays about it. And the thing was, one of the essays I wrote got a whole lot of attention from other people. There were so many women who wrote me where the same thing had happened to them or who called me. And I found myself comforting them. And that actually helped me get out of the abyss of it all, because in comforting others, I felt stronger myself, and I was able to move on by trying to help other people in the same situation move on too.
Thank you, Caroline.
You're welcome.
You're amazing. Having someone that you loved very deeply to pass on like that very suddenly is very unfair and cruel to anyone.
It was really awful. We were just, you know, in bed sleeping, and he woke up and said, I don't feel well. And he went to sit on the couch, and I got up to sit with him. And then he said, I need to go to the hospital. And I said, okay, I'm just going to get dressed. And then he collapsed. And the big thing was, in order to get to the phone, which was in the kitchen, I had to stop giving him CPR to get the phone. Then I ran back to him to give him CPR. And by the time the paramedics came, he was just dead. They told me that it was some kind of congenital heart defect, and that it hadn't mattered that he was healthy and, you know, he was a runner and all this stuff. It just was something I couldn't have known that happened. And the thing about it is that I felt there was a layer of life that was torn off, and it actually makes you more compassionate and more afraid to an extent also, because you know that anything can happen at any time. But on the other hand, if you know that anything can happen at any time, then you tend to try to live life to the fullest, which is what I try to do every day.
Yeah. Oh my God. Tearing up right now.
I know. It was really hard. It was really, really hard.
Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry I made you talk about that.
But
at the same time, I'm grateful, because I think that's such an important reminder for everyone too, you know?
It's good to talk about it. It's actually really good to talk about it. And I think one thing too is that when someone dies, you don't end their relationship with them. You still carry on the relationship. A lot of people who are grieving are told to get over it or move on. And the thing is, you do move on, but you still have that relationship, and you still can honor it by, you know, thinking about it and having these pleasant memories. There's no reason to obliterate it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I'm like a mess right now. Yeah, that was really powerful. Thank you, Caroline.
You're welcome.
For people who might be listening who have gone through very tragic, whether it's expected or unexpected situations, like you said, the relationship with these specific people, whether it's your significant other or family members, you still continue to have these relationships.
Yes.
Do you find that like a common thread that almost haunts you throughout your work or ties through all of your work? Do you notice anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. I absolutely do. I always think in terms of, you never know how much time you have, so you should do everything that you can. I mean, that was partly why I decided to have a child with my husband. And at the time we decided to have a child, we had no money at all. We really had no money. We couldn't afford to have a child. And I kept saying, well, let's just go do it anyway. And my husband said, okay, let's just go do it and see what happens. So I had this amazing pregnancy and I felt so lucky. And at the same time, I kept feeling, I wonder when the other shoe is going to drop. And when my son was born and he was perfectly healthy, I thought, oh, this is great. Nothing's wrong. And then 3 days when I was just about to go home, I got sick. And I don't remember, I was still in the hospital. And I don't really remember what it was. But apparently, I got this acquired kind of very, very rare hemophilia where I wasn't stopping bleeding. And they were taking me into the operating room and opening me up. And they told me later it was like something out of The Shining where the blood just kept coming and coming
And
they
didn't.
So the thing is, they put me into a medical coma for a few weeks to figure out what was wrong with me. And they gave me memory blockers. I'm not sure why. I think they said it was they didn't want me to remember the pain, or it made it easier for them to do whatever tests they were going to do.
So interesting.
But they didn't think I was going to survive. And when I woke up and I sort of processed all this, I remember thinking, okay, this is something else that happened to me. And I have to get through this no matter what. And I had this sense every day that I was not going to give into it, that I was going to fight, and it was going to be okay. It was okay. I mean, it took a year. It literally took a year to get better. But then I was. And I remember looking around saying, oh, I have this beautiful, perfect baby. And I have this perfect, beautiful husband who stayed with me the whole time I was sick. And I have this life and everything's going to be okay. And I sort of feel this now that whatever happens, I'm going to be able to get through it as best I can.
You are so strong. It's ridiculous.
I mean, I certainly wish those things hadn't happened to me. But the fact that they did, I keep saying it makes me feel that I'm strong. And also, it makes me feel much more connected to other people in the world because I feel so much compassion for anybody going through a tough time and anyone who's struggling. And it makes me feel stronger to be able to help them.
My God, Miss Mother Teresa over here. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, don't say that. I have my moments too.
You went through a lot. And, you know, for someone like me, I don't doubt that when people are in a coma, whether it's medically induced or not, I do believe that they go through another state. You said they put a memory blocker, and I can't help but wonder if a memory blocker that allowed you, almost opening up like a gateway even more to your subconscious, and if you had a very profound experience.
Yes.
Could you share that if it's okay with you? I'm just
so curious
about that.
They gave me the memory blocker. And then when I finally came out, I was in the hospital for 4 months and then in bed at home for the rest of the year. But when I came out of the coma, that I was on really, really high doses of morphine. And when I finally got to go home, it was almost like having post-traumatic stress syndrome because I would see certain things and I would get panicky. And later when I was able to go out, I remember being in a supermarket and I saw this packaged soup and I started shaking and I was really scared. My husband said, oh, that was the only thing that you would eat when you were allowed to eat was this kind of soup. And certain smells that were hospital smells, certain lotions and stuff would set me off. And I do remember presences and certain voices. And I remember I was really mad that they gave me the memory blockers because I thought, well, what if I had a near-death experience and I'm pissed off I didn't remember it? And I went to a therapist and the therapist said, you know, the only way you can heal is you have to process this. And if you don't remember it, you have to create it. And he was the one who told me to write a book about it and make up what I didn't remember. And that way I could work it through. And I did. There's still things that I don't remember. And people have told me stuff, but a lot of times people didn't want to talk about it because it was so difficult for them. It was such a hard time for my husband and a really hard time for my friends. And so I have to respect that they don't want to tell me the details that I really want to know.
No.
But
like,
again,
but it's involving me.
Right. Right. And the funny thing is that when I asked the doctors to tell me, most of what they were telling me had to do with how they were saving my life. It was mostly about them more than it was about me. So there's some things that I won't know. I'm still so very interested in that altered state. And that's actually sort of what I'm writing about now.
Oh
in
my gosh,
novel.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm so interested in it and what it does and how it opens you up and how it changes you. And
I'll be the first one to buy that book. I'm not even
oh,
kidding.
Good.
I'm very excited for that as well. All of your work is beautiful. And
thank you.
To also touch on that state of mind, that's very fascinating to me too. And hence why I keep prying with all these questions.
I love that you are. Oh. It's so moving to me.
Oh, thank you. You're so sweet. You see, this is why you are the best writing teacher to go to. You're always allowing your students to spew out with story ideas. There's never any judgment. I'll always remember that about you. Since we were talking about how amazing your husband is, Jeff, he's also a writer.
Yep. We say he tells the truth because he writes nonfiction and I get to lie. He's a really fine writer and an editor. He writes about music a lot. He was the editor of a world music magazine. Then he was an editor at Jazz Times. Now he's the editor of this online magazine about music from the 60s and 70s. We read each other's work and we really help each other. And we work across from each other in offices on the third floor of our house. It's been great. We're together almost all the time and I love it.
That is the cutest thing because you guys do work in the same space. Do you guys ever get on each other's nerves?
No.
That's amazing. I love that. I love that because it's in your own space. How do you make sure that you guys are in your own? For me, I would be blabbing on. So what are we going to eat for lunch? What are we going to eat for dinner? Oh my God, that meal was amazing, right?
Well, we do do that. I mean, we do wander into each other's office. But we have a policy that if the door is closed, that means we need real privacy. And the door is almost never closed unless, you know, we're doing an interview or we're on a really specific deadline. But I'm always in his office saying, let's play hooky and go to the movies.
That's so cute, you guys. Oh my, you both are amazing. I guess you guys don't have issues at all with making date nights happen. I guess it just kind of happens throughout any time of the day, either the morning date, a coffee date, or a movie date. That's
right.
So cool. Talk about a spicy marriage. I like it. I like it. And I love to jump back into Cruel, Beautiful World. And if you remember a very challenging scene that you were struggling with, you say you spend about 6 months to get that all hashed out. I'm not surprised if you say that there weren't any challenges too much.
There were huge challenges all the way through. By the time it got to my editor, I must have done about 18 rewrites. The book was sold already, and she read the book. She said, you know, I really love this book, but there's a lot of stuff you have to change. She wanted me to find the love between all the relationships, between the sisters and the sisters and the mother and the guys in the book. And I was adamantly opposed to it because I thought, oh, she's going to turn it into a nice book. And I wanted this dark, thorny book. And I kept objecting to it. And she kept saying, well, just try it and see what happens. Because I think you'll have a more haunting book that way. And it'll actually be much more powerful. And it was really, really hard for me. And I wrote one revision after another revision. And finally, after about the sixth revision, I realized, oh my God, she's right. And she was, and it was really, really hard. And she had other things that she wanted me to change that were, I can't tell you what they were because it'll give away plot.
Okay.
But
no,
it was but it was really, really hard. And we had a lot of talks about it on the phone. And she would talk me through it. And I would try something out. And she would say, no, it's not right yet. And I would go back. And I would, there was a lot of crying on my end. But I finally got it worked up.
That's pretty awesome that you had that support system to go back and forth with. I think that's so helpful too. It's really tough doing that on your own. And that actually also just inspired another question. Pulling out from what I remembered reading from some of our listeners for that listener survey, there are listeners out there who are stuck in their first draft. These are people who don't have that support system just yet, maybe a little bit tight on finances or saving up, could be just students just graduating.
Right.
So they can't really take a workshop, which is what I always encourage. I kind of realize not everyone can take a workshop at that very moment. So for those who are working and trying to edit and polish their manuscript and they've completed their first draft and they're really determined about taking the traditional publication route and they're stuck on editing their manuscript for the querying stage, the more clinical aspect of breathing life onto the page when you're writing the first draft, what would you advise them if they're looking for concrete steps to edit their manuscript to a point where they feel really proud, where they're like, you know what, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Literary Agent, I'm ready. I'll bring it on.
There's a lot they can do. There's a lot of free writers groups online where you don't have to pay anything. And it's a group of writers. The trick is you need to find the right mix. I think there's one Authors Den or Writers Unboxed. They should just go on those sites and interact with writers and see how other writers are writing and then approach them and say, look, do you want to do a manuscript swap? I'll look at yours and you can look at mine or whatever. And you do it for free. And you learn to give feedback. And then you get great feedback back, and it's good karma. And I'm sure there's a lot more than the two places I listed. People should just do a search, because once you have a writing community or a writer's group, or you can even form one in your area, just get on Facebook and say, I'm forming a writer's group in Boston or wherever you are. And you get like six people and you meet every week and you read each other's work and you do it for free and you get to have friends, and it's great and it's helpful.
And what about those who have some money saved up and have had a 9-to-5 or still having a 9-to-5. And let's say they saved up, I don't know, like $1,000 on the side or $1,500 on the side specifically to spend on writing resources that would help them improve their manuscripts. Now then, what would you advise from there?
Okay, if they have that amount of money to spend, they're in really good shape. They can hire personal manuscript consultants. I do that kind of work, and I charge a little bit more. I charge $2,000, but I will say that sometimes when people contact me, if I have time and if the project is really interesting to me, if it speaks to me, and I want to be careful to say that that doesn't mean that something is good or not good. It just means that I think I might be the right editor for it. I will do it for $1,500. But there are many people who can do that. I have two colleagues who are excellent, who actually read my work, who would do it for that amount of money. It's hard to find somebody really good for just $1,000, but you can find people who will do it for that and for $500. I'm just not sure how specific and how great the help would be. Most of the people I know who are doing this charge within $1,500 to $2,500.
Yes, for a manuscript. That's understandable. Absolutely.
Right. But it's worth it because you're getting published writers who really know how to help you. But what I would suggest to everybody, and this is what I offer, is if you're going to go and pay money for someone to be a consultant, ask them to look at and mark up your first two pages for free, which is what I do. Because then you'll know immediately if this person is the right editor for you or not. And sometimes they're not. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just means it's not a good match. It doesn't mean your work isn't good. It just means that it's not the right editor for you. And what I do is, if I'm not the right editor, I just send them to two other editors that I know to see if they might be a good match. Because that's important. You have to trust the person who's editing you. You have to like them. You have to feel that there's some kind of a bond going on for the whole process to really work.
That says so much about you, someone who really partakes in moving this community forward and giving back, because you have no qualms whatsoever sharing that and sharing your resources too, and your friends' work, and recommending them and matching them up with the writers.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Caroline. I know listeners would very much appreciate that. For those who feel like, okay, they've done the free workshops and free writing critiques and the groups that they've joined and want to get it to the next level of really one-on-one focus from published authors, it's great that they know how much they should save. Even if that means working extra shifts, hours, or getting a side job, boom, then they can either go to you or anybody else that is great at what they do, then they have that. I would love to know, job-wise, I'm sure everybody can relate, how were you able to, quote unquote, survive as a writer while putting a roof over your head?
I did a lot. I had a job as a full-time freelance copywriter at Macy's for years and years. And it was 9-to-5. And I really loved it because they liked me and they let me do whatever I wanted. So I could write a lot and during lunch and stuff. Then I had a job. I was full-time staff at Columbia House writing about videos for about 7 years. And I hated that. And I finally left after I had my son. I did a whole lot of different things. I wrote books for Wishbone, which was a PBS series for kids, and that was very lucrative. And when that stopped, yeah, it was great. When that stopped, then I started teaching at UCLA and then Stanford, and then I took on private clients. That's mostly what I do now. And the only other thing I do for money is I'm a professional namer with Eat My Words, which is this really cool naming companies. And I get to name products and stores and restaurants. And there's a lot that writers can do where you can do at home. But it takes a while to build up your clientele. As long as I don't have to go in an office, I'm great.
You're so resourceful. You're so creative. Just going from writing for the Wishbone series then to the super lucrative job, were you looking at job listings or was it word of mouth?
It's all word of mouth. You have to build up your reputation. A lot of it was on Facebook, just telling people, oh my God, I need money, I need a job. And then people would suggest things. Because every ad I've ever answered on Craigslist or anything else never resulted in a job. It's always been, you do something, you get known, and then somebody says, oh, I have this for you, do you want to do this? And then it just builds up on that.
It's really refreshing when you see like a very honest and genuine comment or a post stating that the truth, which is you're going through some hard times right now, you're struggling, but you would love any referrals or pointers on a job opportunity. You say it where it's not in a demanding way, or just being honest and letting them know, laying it out there. And people want to help those who are honest enough to be vulnerable.
I'm a big believer in honesty. I think there's no, you know, what have you got to lose?
Now with touring, you're putting aside the writing classes, right?
No, I'm still teaching as I'm touring. I take my laptop with me and I do it at 2 a.m. in the hotel. Or if I do it on the train, that's what I do.
Damn, there you go. There's no excuse.
No one else has
any excuse. If they were going to want to write, you're going to have to make time for it. You have to make time. And what about those conferences that you're doing, the live streaming, seeing each other's faces in class? Are you doing that on the train?
Absolutely. Nothing stops me.
That's kind of fun because your students feel like they're on tour with you. And I would love to also ask you, what was the proudest moment in your career?
I think it was selling my first novel. It really was, because I never expected it. And everything that came after it, I never expected either. But it was that first moment where I felt, oh, you know, this is happening and this is exciting. And that still sort of stayed with me.
Do you remember where you were at, where you were standing, who you were with?
Yeah, I was at a ballet class in Pittsburgh, and I got a phone call. I remember the first thing I did is I called my mom to tell her.
But how was her reaction?
She was so proud. She was really so proud. Oh my God. That was just wonderful.
Your family is very supportive of your writing, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah.
There was no disagreements on when you came out to say, hey, family, I'm going to become a writer.
Well, that was different. Before I published, yes, there were always disagreements about it because my mother and father felt that that was not a career choice, that I should be a teacher or a wife or whatever else. And I mean, there was always a feeling of, well, this is nice. This is a nice hobby. But that changed once I started publishing. That was a little difficult, but that changed.
Your son, Max, he's an actor.
Yes, he is. He's a really talented actor. He has his own little film company now, and he's like Pace Performing Arts, and he's doing really, really well.
Congratulations. You must
Thank
be
you.
Very proud. It shows that him pursuing his dreams, having his own film company, acting, it just shows how supportive you are and says a lot, because you, the mom being, both parents actually, being creative and coming from the art side as well, being writers,
is huge
for children. And I think that's fantastic. Have you always been encouraging?
Always, since he was a little kid. He wanted to be in theater, so we found him classes.
I would love to know what you think about mentors in your career and life overall. Do you think it's a necessary thing to have and to seek out?
It definitely is. It's been so important for me. I've been helped so much by other writers who showed me the ropes, or who, you know, got me to agents or got me to editors or suggested things that I might do. I have a notebook full of people that I can call, and it's just really important. You need people who know things, who can help you, and who are willing to share. So it's been very, very important for me.
And how were you able to find these mentors?
Actually, with social media. I'm very upfront on social media, and I talk to a lot of writers, and I post on their page. And through that, most of the times I would just meet people and I would talk about their family or what they were having for dinner or whatever. And we became friends. And then once you become friends and you start getting into other stuff, or people knew I was a writer, or then I would meet them at readings. And once we knew each other, then we want to help each other. So that's sort of how it came about. But I definitely would say that social media is so helpful. That's how I met my whole writers community. And then I would start going out and meeting them in the flesh.
That's really cool because social media, it's everywhere. It's very accessible right. for people. That's awesome. What are some small manageable steps that you could advise writers, especially aspiring beginner writers who are right. just jumping in this journey?
There are a whole lot of steps for writers. The first thing is get on social media. Befriend other writers. Make sure under your name it says that you're a writer, because that's what people look at when they decide whether to friend you or not. And talk to them the way you would at a cocktail party. Find out if they post about their kids, you can talk about their kids. If they post about books they're reading, you can talk about the books they're reading. What you don't want to do is like come on and say, I'm a writer, how can you help me? You want to get to know the person. Another thing that new writers should do that I always recommend is that writing personal essays is a great way to get attention, especially if you write one for Modern Love in the New York Times style section, because they don't care who you are. You don't need any qualifications whatsoever. All you have to do is write an essay, put it in an email, send it to Modern Love. If they like it, they'll answer you in 4 weeks. I know people who sent stuff in and they got movie deals.
What?
Yep. And I know people got book deals from it. It's a great way to get your name out there. There are tons of places online who also don't care who you are, if you've ever published before, and they're really great places. There's this place called the Manifestation. It's like manifest-station. They have millions of followers, and it's a wonderful place to publish. The Millions is great. The Rumpus is great. Slate is great. Bustle is great. Lenny Letter is great. That's how you get seen and noticed, and it'll help you for your book.
Wow. Thank you so much for all those incredible resources. Jumping right into that, are there any books that you can recommend to listeners to check out, whether it's about craft on writing or, of course, obviously check out your books. Also, any other books too?
Yes. I always use in my classes Lisa Cron, C-R-O-N, Wired for Story is a great resource. And John Truby, it's in paperback. It's called The Anatomy of Story Structure. That's really, really great. And there's a book by Jeff Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S. I think it's called The Anatomy of Premise. It's a great book. Great book.
Amazing. Caroline, that's so awesome. You've been wonderful. And let's wrap it up. Where could we find you and also find out about your tour schedule? Is it on your website, Twitter, Facebook?
Yep, it's carolinelevitt.com. And I'm always on Facebook and I'm always on Twitter at Levitt Novelist. And I have to thank you. This was the best interview ever. I just loved it. And I loved your questions and I love you.
And that wraps up our episode with the amazing Caroline Levitt. Caroline, I'm so happy to have had you on the show. It was such an honor, and thank you for being so incredibly generous and kind with our storyteller community. Storytellers, thank you for listening in and joining us as always. Please head over to Twitter and say hi to Caroline at Levitt Novelist. Caroline recommended a ton of really helpful books and resources for you to check out, and we have them all linked up in her show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Caroline Levitt. Don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other writers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we also post sneak peeks of future episodes. Join me over in our new Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you there. At the very top of the show, I mentioned Vermont College of Fine Arts. I know there's a lot of you who are really interested in writing books for children or young adults, so you'll definitely want to pay special attention to what Vermont College of Fine Arts has to offer. VCFA has 3 different graduate level programs for writers, and I'll be going into detail about their program called Writing for Children and Young Adults. Students meet up twice a year on their gorgeous campus in the heart of historic Montpelier in Vermont for intensive 10-day residencies. It's a lot like 10-day retreats for writers, and you guys know how much I love retreats. Imagine attending VCFA's MFA program where you'll be immersed in an amazing writing community filled with intensive workshops, lectures, panel discussions, and readings that are always challenging and inspiring you. After the life-changing experiences at the residencies, you and the faculty will design your own course for the start of the semester by really zoning in on your specific writing goals. Throughout the semester, you'll continue working with faculty mentors through telephone conferences, emails, and letters. So basically, you're receiving one-on-one mentorship throughout your semester as you take control in shaping the kind of education you want out of your time with VCFA. Check out 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA for more info.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.